स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृत्तश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्सार्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः विकल्पः विकल्पो विनिवर्तेत कल्पितो यदि केनचित् उपदेशात् अयं वादः ज्ञाते द्वैतं न विद्यते विकल्पः विनिवर्तेत कल्पितः यदि केनचित् उपदेशात् अयं वादः ज्ञाते द्वैतं न विद्यते Vikalpa just means division or duality. And so there are, in this creation, which just is like a manifestation of infinite groups and infinite duality, there are many, many vikalpas. For one vikalpa would just be the five elements, you know, the space, air, fire, water, earth. That's a grouping. You can divide the whole universe into that group. There's also, I mean, it's really limitless in terms of the different types of divisions we can make in reference to the universe. Or in reference to relation, you can look at the father, son, mother, daughter, sister, brother. These are all vikalpas. They're all divisions. They're all a duality. So there being limitless vikalpas here, they're talking about one in particular. Because all of the vikalpas, all of the types of duality that we experience in the world, in fact, there's really nothing. Those vikalpas are self-generating, self-perpetuating. But the vikalpa between the acharya, the shastra, the acharya is also called the shastra, the teacher. The acharya, the teacher, the teaching, the shastra, the Vedanta shastra, the Upanishads, the shastra, you know, and the sishya. This is the vikalpa. And this particular verse is directed at this vikalpa, at this dvaita, because it is this vikalpa that actually removes the vikalpas. It actually removes, in a sense, when we have to figure out how that happens, it actually removes the vikalpa. Or we would more correctly say, it reduces the vikalpas, it reduces the duality that we experience to mitya. It makes this duality mitya. When we make the duality that we experience mitya, we continue to experience the duality. Why this is would be called duality in any type of what we call any type of absolute reality, like paramartika, a paramartika, is when it's not mitya, but we take it to be satyam. It means this duality that we experience is the reality. If we say that something is mitya, then this duality that we experience has no being at all apart from whatever is the satyam, or what we call the adhishtana, the underlying truth of the duality that we experience. So it's a big, big shift in terms of the entire creation to go from this being paramartika, this world being the reality that we live in, this body, mind, sense, organs is the reality of me, this person, and this world that I experience is the world that is here. This is the reality. To go from this as being the paramartika, this is the the reality that we experience to being mithya is a huge jump. You can't just move, you can't go to mithya. You can't just jump to mithya. You can't just say, oh, well, this is really mithya. It doesn't mean anything without recognizing the satyam. Satyam can't be deemed as mithya without recognizing what it depends on for its being. For something to be called mithya, it means that whatever it is dependent of totally, 100%, not partially, but totally 100% upon something else for its being. And that means that it itself has no being of its own. It's a good old clay pot example. If I remove the clay, there is no pot. In fact, there is only clay. That's the satyam-mithya relationship. Rope snake, again, is satyam-mithya relationship. If I remove the rope, there is no snake. The snake, for its being, is totally dependent on the rope. And so between the rope and the snake, there's no real dvaita. There's no really any duality. There's only one rope there. In the clay pot, you don't have pot and clay. You have clay. And the pot has its usefulness, but it is not a second for there to be any advaita. And so for us to understand non-duality or to realize non-duality, how are you going to do that? How is that going to take place? When you yourself, everything that you use to gain knowledge is mithya. In other words, you're within the duality. And so is it that you have to erase yourself, this body, mind, sense organs person that is getting this knowledge? Does this person have to be erased in order to understand, in order to recognize Advaita? It's kind of like saying, is it one or the other? So here we are as individuals and teaching is going on. Does the Advaita that we're experiencing have to be eradicated in order to recognize, to appreciate Advaita, non-duality? Do I have to get rid of this experience of duality in order to appreciate non-duality? And then there's the problem, this problem comes in that too. Say if we think that way, well, I'm going to have to wipe out this duality that's being experienced so that I can appreciate the non-dual. The next question is, in this vikalpa that we're talking about between the teacher, the student, the teacher, the teaching, and the student, where do they stand in all of this? You know, is the teacher real? Is the teacher some sort of satyam, an absolute reality other than this creation, free from dvaita? Is the teaching itself or the Upanishads outside of duality? Is the student outside of duality? No. So do they have some? When this knowledge is taking place, is there some other order of reality that the knowledge is enjoying? Is there another order of reality that the knowledge is enjoying outside of this duality that is being dismissed? See what I mean? So are the Upanishads themselves? Are the Upanishads themselves satyam or outside of the duality? Or are they mithya also? Is the teacher mithya? And the student mithya? And the Upanishads mithya? Then how can this mithya teacher, you know, teach a mithya Upanishad to a mithya student and gain any sort of freedom from doing that? How does that all work? So that's what this verse is about. So he says, this vikalpa, first thing he says is, the vikalpa itself, the duality itself, vinivarteta, this is a potential, vikalpa is in the nominative, vikalpaha, this vikalpa, this dvaita, vinivarteta, it would be dismissed, it would be eradicated, right? Kalpitaha, if this vikalpa itself, yadi means it, if it was itself projected by someone, kenachit means by someone. If someone projected this, then it could be eradicated. I'll give you some examples for that in a minute. Then we could just eradicate it, you know. But there's nobody projecting it. There's nobody projecting this mithya. That's what we have to talk about. So then what he says is, upadeshat ayam vadaha. This type of talk, this type of teaching, the teaching itself, is for the sake of the upadesha, this vikalpa, the vikalpa between the teacher, the teaching, and the student, ayam vadaha, this description, is upadesha, because of the upadesha, you know, because of the, for the sake of the teaching. But when it is known, when what is being taught is known, nyate, then what we find is not that the duality is dismissed or eradicated. That's not what we find. So we don't find that it's eradicated. We find that there is no duality. There is no duality. But being here, experiencing this duality, the experience of the duality itself doesn't, doesn't displace Advaita. You can't have duality and Advaita. You can't have the combination. We have some duality over here and some non-duality over here. If that were the case, then the non-duality on this side, you know, would mean that the non-duality on this side would mean that this Advaita itself was limited by this duality. Right? So for there to be non-duality, there can't be any competition. There can't be a second thing. If there's a second thing, then there's duality. It's very simple. So if anything in this creation, right, makes for two, then we have duality. So you can't have, say, even if you think of, well, let's have a meditative experience where for the moment I'm as though, right, eradicating duality, which we do if we try to practice some absorption of the mind. You're eradicating duality temporarily. You're not really eradicating it. You're turning your back on it. Right? Like if I shut my eyes right now, I am now free of the experience of color. Totally free of it. It's gone. You know? If I'm able to plug my ears, sound is gone. If I'm able through pranayama and different meditative exercises to actually stop my mind, thoughts are gone. If I absorb my mind, kind of like holding a candle flame up to the sun, you know, where the content of my mind is just the satchit of my being, then at that time, there is no perception of duality. So would that mean then, is that what I'm going to have to do? Do I have to eradicate the duality, you know, to have a non-experience of duality in order to be non-dual? This is the doubt, and this is the doubt that's being expressed in this verse. Then how would we do that? Would it be the eradication of something that is actually there? And how are you going to eradicate it? Would being away from the experience of a duality that is there eradicate it? That's the problem. If you're turning away from a duality that is there, if you're turning away your experience from a duality that is there, the only thing that's happening there is that you're not experiencing it. It's still duality, you know? And so to the degree that there is any kind of duality whatsoever, to that degree, there is duality. If you have a meditative experience where you're just sitting with nirvikalpa samadhi, you know, and then, of course, you come out of that, but you're sitting in nirvikalpa samadhi, means your mind is in an absorbed state. You are what we would say, the mind is having a non-dual experience. It's having a non-dual experience. But that's all it is. It's a non-dual experience that's taking place within duality, because the mind that has absorbed itself into the non-dual conscious, satchitananda, the consciousness that your own being, then comes back and is then flooded by the experience of duality. And so we have then a desire to sit in the non-dual. We sit in the non-dual, and hopefully at some time maybe we'll just stay there forever. That's actually very close to Sankhya Yoga. The Sankhya fold, not so much the Patanjali Yoga, which can go toward so many different darshanas. The Patanjali Yoga is used in so many different darshanas, but for Sankhya Yoga, which is totally dvaita, totally dualistic, They look at this world, this physical world, as real, as real, as real as the Purusha, means as the conscious being. For them, every conscious being, you're a conscious being, you're a Purusha, all separate, you're a Purusha. So there's an infinite number of Purushas, and then there's this physical world, which is an equal order of reality. They are not trying to be non-dual at all. That's not their intent. And so what they are saying is that you as the jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, has to come into a state of equipoise where you practice meditation long enough, so that the mind never wants to come out of that state, and the prakriti comes into as though a permanent state of quiescence, so the individual conscious being can just float around there with no experience, without having to experience the very real prakriti. And so somehow I think this is a common understanding of Advaita, of non-duality, that I have to have a non-dual experience. But then you're not accounting for the rest of the dual world. And we wouldn't call that non-dual, because there are other things besides that. See what I mean? If there's something else besides that, you have that non-dual experience, and then you have this dual experience, and this dual experience. Well, that's not non-dual, because there are many different experiences. So to be non-dual, to understand non-dual, we have this infinite creation and this body, mind, sense organs, all of which is dual, right? And then the question is this experience of duality and the experience of subject, me the subject and you the object, subject-object, does that establish duality? Does our experience of duality that we're having right now establish the reality of duality? And if you say, you know, that, I mean, that becomes the question. And here, the vikalpa they're looking at, and so they ask, okay, well, does your experience of duality establish the reality of duality? Or how can we dismiss this experience of duality to establish non-duality? How do you go about doing that? Is there something that comes from the non-dual to teach you? Say, no, nothing comes from the non-dual to teach you, because the non-dual is one without a second. Something has to come within here to teach you. And so what they say is it's kind of like, they use the example of if you're in a dream tiger can wake you up. It's like the ones who are in the dream have to solve the problem of the dream, have to get you out of the dream. And like here in this creation, the ones who are in the mithya, within the creation, have to release you from the creation. And what type of a release is it? So that would mean that what they're saying is that the guru, the Vedanta, the Upanishads, the teaching methodology, and the student, the sishya, the guru and the sishya, and the Upanishads and the Vedas, all of them are mithya. You know, this teaching is mithya. Everything it has to say is mithya, in terms of the words that are being used. But the question is, can the words that are being used reveal what is satyam? Remember, mithya means that which totally depends, 100% depends for its being upon something else. This whole creation is viewed as mithya. Can a mithya guru, you know, give knowledge to a mithya sishya that frees the sishya from duality? And that's the question. Then you would say, and some students, Swamiji, will joke about this, because some people will think, you know, if the truth is Advaita, if the truth is Advaita, what happens when I get this knowledge? When I get this knowledge, will everything disappear? You know? And the reason we say we have these kind of doubts is if you think of something as mithya, and we use an example like, there's three or four different examples. One is like the rope snake. Another example like the rope snake is if you're walking along at night and you see out of the corner of your eyes a scary man, you know, in the darkness. That's actually only a post. But what you see is a scary man. What you see is a snake. Right? When I gain knowledge of the vastu, and when I gain knowledge of what is actually there, the snake goes away. I didn't create the snake. This is an interesting thing. You didn't create that snake. It's not you, like you were walking along and said, oh, let me imagine a snake on a rope. That creation took place. That maya took place. For you to remove the maya, you have to see what is actually there. The rope. Then the snake goes away. You have to see the post. Then the scary man goes away. But you have to see what, you have to see the satyam, what is actually there. But here in these examples, when you gain knowledge of what is actually there, the mithya goes away in that type of an example. But here, the mithya creation is not going to go away because it's not what we call pratibhasika. Pratibhasika means it's a subjective projection. It is true for my subjective projections. They're coming out of my imagination, my own little personal maya. These projections, when they take place, you know, I'm also not making them take place, which is interesting, but they're still subjective, coming out of my mind. And so when I see what is actually there, that subjective projection is gone. But here in Vyavahara means this empirical reality, this body, mind, sense organs is not your subjective projection. This is part of Ishwara's projection. This is part of the total projection. And so now, when you gain knowledge of this, what is actually here, the truth of what is actually here, since the projection is not subjective, it's not going to go away. It's kind of like, they use this example, like, we experience the rising and setting sun. And when you gain knowledge, even a nishta, means a clarity of knowledge, that the sun is actually not rising, but all the planets are going around it, you gain that knowledge, you have no doubt, and you go on experiencing the rising and the setting of the sun. But your orientation is totally different. Your emotional response is totally different because you understand what you're seeing. You could also believe that the earth was flat and the sun was rising up. And starting to, Jung talks about, I think some Pueblo Indians had something like this. The sun would rise, and then as it would arc, it would then start to fall, you know, to the other side. And who knows if it was going to come up again? Who knows? And so their task was to pray continuously, say prayers and do rituals to keep the sun coming up. Because they didn't know. And for them, their prayers was what was responsible for the sun blessing them and coming up. Right? What I'm saying is that's a belief, you know. It's more than a belief. It's what we would call their containing myth, what they believe to be true. And their emotional response, you know, and the way they view life is based upon that belief. Just like for us, very simply, if you go back to the snake, if you experience a snake or a scary man, your emotional response is to the snake or the scary man. It's not to the post. Right? And it's not to the rope. It's to what you experience. It's your experience of reality. Yeah? But so here, when I'm talking about this rising and setting sun, that's a projection. That's not real. That's an illusion. Right? But once I understand it's an illusion, even though I go on experiencing it, I don't have the same emotional response as if I felt the sun was crashing and may never come back. Maybe this is going to be an eternal darkness now. So I'm not subject to that type of emotional response. And so here, in terms of Advaita, the experience of Advaita, once I understand what it is, once I recognize the vastu, because with the vastu means what actually is there. Once I recognize and recognize the truth of my experience, I'll say it that way. Once I recognize the truth of my experience and the truth of my being, then the way that I'm responding to this world is not as paramarthika. It's not as an absolute reality. It's mithya. It's mithya because I understand, I recognize the adhishtana of my being, the truth of my being, which is the truth of this creation that I'm experiencing. I recognize it and I see it. I see it clearly. That changes the emotional response that you have to the world. The dvaita becomes what we call, the duality that we experience, becomes what we call bhadita. It's an important word. Bhadita means it's negated while still being present. Bhadita means the reality of something has been negated, even though it is still present. So the duality that we experience becomes bhadita, and not reduced to mithya, but the mithyatva that is recognized. And then when that's so, my response to the world changes because I see it differently. But what changes? Let me just back up a little. The world that is here as Ishwara's projection continues to be here. It's not like you gain knowledge and then you all disappear. Right? This is some people's fear. The world continues as it is, but it continues as mithya. You recognize the mithyatva because you understand the vastu is actually there. But what changes in a rope snake way is the mental projections, the emotional reactions and mental projections that were brought about by your relating to the world in a way that it isn't. Those subjective projections go away like the snake. What is not your creation, you know, doesn't go away. The subjective projections go away. So let me give you an example of what that would be. If the emotional life is all governed by raga dvesha, by our likes and dislikes. Raga dvesha, likes and dislikes, follow a desired template. The desired template for somebody who doesn't have knowledge is the full desired template is this. I need this, whatever this is. I need this in order to be happy. This is samsara. That's the full desire template. Positive and negative. I need this in order to be happy. And I need to get rid of this. The negative is, and I need to get rid of this in order to be happy. In order to be full. In order to be complete. That's samsara. That's the gasoline that keeps us running. I need this, and I need this, and I need this. And it can be in terms of people, it can be in terms of environment, it can be in terms of anything and everything. For the jnani, so let's look at the desire template again. If I say, I need this in order to be happy, and I don't need this in order to be happy, basically what I need is to be happy. I need to be happy. I need to be whole, I need to be complete, I need to be full, I need to feel meaningful, all of these words. So we'll just use happy for it. I need to be happy. And then I insert in this, I need to be happy, this. This thing keeps changing. And these, all of the thises become the means for becoming happy. Right? So I need this, and I need this, and I need this combination, and this, and this, and this, and this, and this, all so that I can be happy. But really all I need is to be happy. It's just I'm inserting all of these things because I think that they would give me that. And so that is the belief in samsara, and that is our experience. It's a pervasive experience. It's a shared delusion. It's not like one person thinks it. We're all sharing in this. And the reason we're sharing in it is because when I get something that I want, I become happy. Even though it's momentary, still, the delusion works. I get this, I really wanted this, I get it, and now I'm happy. I feel relief and happiness and ananda in my mind. And it's every time that way. Sometimes if I have a bigger desire, I'll have a bigger happiness when I get it. If it's just a little desire, I have a little, it's not that intense, I have a little happiness. But still, it works. And it works for everybody. And so we all believe in it. And it's a very painful situation because we can't control our life. We can't control the environment, you know. We can't control, you can't say, well, I need this to get to be happy, and so here it is. I need this to be happy, and so it'll come to me. It's not like that at all. You know? And even if it does come to me, how long does it last? It's like you only get little moments of little breathers. So this is how human beings live in the world, because it matches their experience. It's logical. Whenever I fulfill a desire, I become happy. But we don't understand the illusion of it. And the illusion is basically, well, yes, every time you fulfill a desire, at that moment you become happy, because at that moment your mind is desireless. It doesn't want anything. So it's tricked you. You fulfill the desire, your mind becomes desireless for a moment. It doesn't want anything. What that means is at that moment, everything is fine with me. And so it's like a clear water bucket reflecting the sun. My mind just becomes so peaceful. And the shanti of my own being, you know, it penetrates, but the wholeness of my being is not in competition with stressful vrittis, with stressful thoughts, with stressful emotions, with stressful feelings. At that moment, I have a shanta vritti. There's no competition, and so the wholeness, what is natural to my own being, is not in competition with stress. Look at what happens when you don't fulfill a desire. When you don't, you really want something, and you don't get it. It's like the door slammed in your face. You don't get it. You feel so devastated or hurt, or your life is spoiled, can go to very big extremes. And so what happens when you don't feel a desire? You feel sad and hurt. You can feel hopeless and in despair. All the negative spectrum of emotions. Also, when you're not fulfilling a desire, there are certain people out there that are not helping you fulfill the desire, and they're at fault also. Mm-hmm. And so then you have really bad relationships with all of these people that are spoiling your life. It goes on and on and on. But what is actually happening is because the ananda, that wholeness of my own self, is projected onto the world, to certain objects in the world. When I don't get that object, it's like I'm not getting myself. And so the mind becomes very stressed, becomes agitated and tense and worried. All of these emotions are what are generated because the wholeness was out here. And so say, what happens when I understand, I mean really understand, not just as a belief, but I really recognize that actually my being itself is the wholeness that I seek. When my mind recognizes that I've just been projecting this out onto the world and then running after it, and my mind understands that its very being is the source of the wholeness that it's seeking, the mind changes. Right? Because it's not running after a projection anymore. You've seen the actual source of the wholeness that had been projected. Now the mind is changing. The rope, the snake isn't there. The snake is no longer there. And so you're not responding to the snake. You're not responding to the world as your source of wholeness or fullness, and you have to be this way, and you have to be this way, and you have to be this way. I have to have this and I have to have that. That all goes away. And it goes away slowly over time as I understand. And all of my projections and my the belief system and the desires slowly subside as my mind is more and more at home with my knowledge. They all subside. And then what am I experiencing? The experience is different. The world is still here. The world is still here. But the world that I'm responding to it differently, because I'm not asking it to be something that actually it isn't, and I'm also not asking it to give me something that it really can't give. You know, if it really could give what you want it to give, that would be one thing. But you actually have never experienced that. You have experienced momentary flashes of wholeness from the fulfillment of your desire. And it's an uncanny thing. It's uncanny. And I think most of us even recognize that it's uncanny. You know, it's an odd experience to fulfill a desire and feel that moment of wholeness and fullness, you know, only to keep whatever it was that was making you so happy, and that's there. And then that happiness just goes away and we're on to the next thing. It just simply goes away. You have what you really wanted. You have it, and it gave you that moment of wholeness. And you are left with it. And we're talking like minutes. You know, you're left with a thing, and that's nice and everything. It's not that you're sad that you're left with a thing, but the ananda, the fullness, the joy, the completion that you got from it is so very momentary. And then we're just back to where we started, and we have the thing. And so the thing, obviously, whatever it may be, it doesn't have anything to do with your ananda. What has to do with your ananda is the relaxation of the mind. And that has nothing to do, even that itself has nothing to do with the ananda itself, the fullness itself, which is your own swarupa, it's your own nature, it never comes and goes at all, it's always there. But that fullness is always in the presence of a mind which is flip-flopping from the negative spectrum of emotion to the positive spectrum, to the negative spectrum to the positive spectrum. And the mind is more concerned about which part of the spectrum it's experiencing now and what is causing that. You know, what's causing these negative emotions, and we have to get rid of those things that are causing these negative feelings, and what is causing these positive feelings? You want to keep all of those. The mind is very, very busy working all of this out, you know, and trying to keep a balance so that I have some, the mind itself has some type of shanti, some type of resting place where it can relax. What about when it doesn't worry about that? What about when that's not a concern? What about when the mind, enjoying the fullness, which is its own being, just like the being of the pot is clay, the pot does not have to work to find the clay, right? It just has to recognize it. You have to just recognize the mind has to recognize the truth of your own being. And then recognizing that, then from out of the fullness, which is that source of my own being, then you experience the world. And how do you experience it? Well, you experience it objectively. And by objective, I don't mean flat. I don't mean like all of a sudden, this is another kind of a spiritual notion. I'm afraid to get knowledge because I won't have any feelings. I don't want to just be flat. Because see, if you recognize, these are all fears. If I recognize the constancy of my own wholeness, my mind recognizes that, then everybody else just becomes the same. Right? So just dry, nothing. I won't have any pravritti. I won't have any inclination to go toward anything. That's the fear. But that isn't true at all. We still, even a jivan mukta, somebody who's a jnani, they still have the preferences. You still have your attractions and your preferences. But But they're mitya. Because I can have a preference. You know, I can enjoy something. I can feel, I can love, all of those things. But it's also fine if it's not there. I'm not devastated if it's not there. Because myself is the constant. My being is the constant. It's kind of the, this is what we call vairagya. Vairagya also has a lot of notions like this. This is how people think of vairagya, dispassion. I'm supposed to not like things. I shouldn't let anything near me, you know. I shouldn't have any kind of feelings for anything. I have to keep everything away from me. So people worry about with vairagya. I don't want to have that kind of vairagya, where I just want to have to keep everybody away. And well, I don't want to have that either. You know, who wants to have that? It's like gain knowledge and become a robot. You know, gain knowledge and have no emotional life. That's not what vairagya is. Vairagya is like the helium balloon. It's the famous example for it. Swamiji's example. A helium balloon. When my parents used to take me to the, when we were little, we used to go to Santa Cruz. And we'd go to the boardwalk and we'd always get these balloons. And of course, somebody's balloon would deflate. It's awful, you know, big balloon just become this little thing. You know? And somebody's balloon was going to let go, you know, and everybody would be very upset, very hurt. Their balloon has been gone, been lost, their cherished balloon, you know. But if you're an adult, chances are, you know, that your relationship with that balloon would be totally different. You could have fun with the balloon and enjoy the balloon as long as it was there and engage with the balloon and play with the balloon and do all kinds of things with the balloon. But when the balloon was gone, that would also be fine. And if you let, and if the balloon got loosened, you could watch it go up into the sky, and that would be fine. And I don't mean pretend fine. It would be fine. It would be fine. And so when the world is like that, you know, where you can be, you are free to be engaged with it, because there's not fear of loss. There's not fear of the loss of yourself, the loss of your being. That creates a totally different type of world. When you withdraw the jiva, really, what happens is the, as you gain knowledge, the jiva, this, the jiva, which is activated really by raga dvesha, by likes and dislikes, real likes, the desire template. That draws the jiva out. You're not always the jiva, even though the, even if for agnani, even when the agnanam is there, the jivatvam of the individual is not always active. Sometimes it's dormant. That jiva, what the jivatvam, like for instance, if you're walking along in the, along the beach, or you're out in nature, or you're in a peaceful spot in your home, and there's nothing pulling at you, where you just are. There's no raga dveshas, likes and dislikes, you know, grabbing your mind and causing you to worry about what to do next and how to make this environment or this situation okay. All of the worry, all of these type of things, it's all raga dvesha. What about all those times when you're just simply present? You're just simply present to what is and engaging in what is without your own well-being being at stake. So you spend quite a bit of time like that, actually. You know, your well-being is not at stake. Not a lot of time, but enough time for you to notice. Your well-being is not at stake. We say at that time, you're objective. You know, you're objective. And so there's a tremendous amount of freedom in that. So what I'm saying is that for this, we're not talking at all here in terms of Advaita about the negation of duality, that the negation of the experience of duality, it's the recognition that there is no duality. Right? That's totally different. Negating duality is I have to make it go away. Recognizing that there is no duality is a whole different ballgame. If you understand, for instance, if you think of the wave ocean analogy, there are countless waves in a very vast ocean, countless waves of all different sizes, right? And there's also foam, also just water, right? So there's all a whole display of diversity and duality. But it's easy for you to recognize that there's only water. But here, when you're looking at and experience the world, you know, with all five sense organs, and with so many different types of duality, emotions, vrittis, imaginations, perceptions, you know, all through the five sense organs, and here we are, the body-mind sense organs walking around within it. So we're enclosed in this. Right? We're enclosed in it. And so to recognize being a jiva within it, to recognize that this is all just my being, to see it, you know, it's a big thing. And we can look at the ocean. And there's a subject-object relationship. Oh, look at that ocean. So many waves and all of that. But really, there's only one water. In fact, the wave and the ocean are one. They're only one water. It's Advaita, really. We can appreciate that. It's a little harder here, where I'm a jiva. I'm an individual within a creation. I'm full of duality. I'm a manifestation of duality in a dual creation. All of my sense organs are, and all of my organs of action, you know, all of my experience validate duality. So I'm born into it. Right? I'm born into duality. And everything about me substantiates the duality. And so to come to a position, you know, to where I see this as just my being, you know, it's not easy. It's not just the snap of the fingers. It's not a shaktipat. If the mind is the one that has to see this, has to recognize it. This shakti, let me give you a non-dual experience. Boom, there. This type of thing, you know, there can be energies like that that give you some sort of a non-dual experience. But then, and I don't really deny that. That can happen, especially in a group where you can have just an incredible experience. But the same problem is there, is that that incredible experience is contextualized within the duality that is your reality. And so there we have a non-dual experience within duality, and non-dual and dual don't make non-dual. What makes non-dual is non-dual, one without a second. You have to be able to say, this is non-dual. And so, how does that take place? Well, that's what the whole Guru Sisha, the whole teaching is about. And that's why the teaching of the, say, the Upanishads, is not just a one-night stand. Because there's a lot that the mind has to understand. This is not a problem for Brahman. It's not a problem for the non-dual. It's not a problem for your being. Your being has no problem. It's non-dual. It's not like it's saying, oh, I need to get some. Your being doesn't need anything. It's already free. It's already whole. It already is the whole. That's what you are. The problem is for the mind. Your mind. And this mind is ensconced in beginningless ignorance. Not because it is ignorance. It is ignorant, as though it's a choice. It's that the whole situation of who you are, how in the creation, by the very fact that you are born in the creation, that ignorance is mandated. Because the mind is limited, the sense organs are limited, the body is limited. There's no way that this limited mind can say, I am the whole, or I am Ishwara. How can a limited mind say that? I only have limited experience. My sense organs have all these epistemological limits. The whole thing about this body and time and place, it has a short lifespan. It is limited, limited, limited. How can you say that I am whole, free, you know, that I am non-dual? I am one without a second? There's nothing there. in your mind or sense organs or means of knowledge that can allow you to say that. Yeah. And yet, the very being that the mind enjoys is that. Right? The very self, your very self, is that. But how's the mind supposed to know that? All the mind does is enjoy the me from its own standpoint. Right? And its own standpoint is limited. It's limited by time and space. Yourself is not subject to time or space. And so now how to make that mind know this? It's not going to be your being that tells you. Even if you have experiences, non-dual experiences, it's non-dual experiences within duality. A dual mind, you know, a limited mind, is having a wonderful experience. And then it comes back and says, let me have that again. How can I have that again? And how can I have that again? Where did it go? You know? And so that's why here, this knowledge has to take place within the Maya itself, within the creation itself. In order to free the mind, you're not freeing the self. You're freeing the mind from the ajnanam, from the ignorance, which has caused it to superimpose itself on the self. Right? So that's where this anyonya adhyasa comes in. And teaching can do that. It can do that. It has the capacity to do that, to remove the ajnanam, because you are there. It's not like there's a non-dual self out there somewhere. It's your very being. It's the very being that is the truth of the mind. And this mind is something which, by its nature, can know, can recognize, can differentiate itself. You can gain knowledge, your mind through your sense organs gains knowledge out here. Of all this world, we're capable of that. But now what has to happen is this mind has to recognize who it is in reference to the self that illumines it. And so its ignorance has to be removed. And when its ignorance is removed, all that happens is that the self, the being that you always have been and always will be, has been differentiated by the mind itself, and the mind becomes part of the creation, part of Ishvara, recognizing that its very being is changeless and not away from anything. But that takes a lot of teaching. It takes a lot of understanding. It's like as this knowledge unfolds, you see it, and then you see it because you're there, it's you. You see it, and then you see it from another standpoint, and then you see it from another standpoint, and you see it from another standpoint, and then you really start to see it. Even though you saw it before, but now you really start to see it. And then you see it from another standpoint, another standpoint, and another standpoint, and then, oh, you really start to see it. Yeah. And all the way, you're seeing it. It's not that you're not. You are seeing it all the way. But it's still contextual. You know, it's the context, the dual context is still creating some doubts, and there's some dark places that have to continually be lit up. And they're lit up one by one by one. That's how it works. And then your emotion, all the emotional life that you have, all of it's been generated within duality. All of it has to do with raga dvesha, and your parents' raga dvesha, you know, and your siblings' raga dvesha, and your partner's raga dvesha. It's all intermixing, and all needs clashing, and all of these kind of things. So there's all kinds of problems that now start to sort themselves out in the light of your knowledge. So your buddhi gains clarity, more and more and more clarity. And as the buddhi gains clarity, all the whole emotional world continues to rise, but now it rises in the one who has clarity. The same emotions, all the same problems keep rising up, but they rise up into somebody different. They rise up into somebody who has a different understanding. And then the one who has a different understanding holds those things differently, that allows them to fall off and transform. It's a very beautiful process that takes place over time. There's an emotional lag time, quite an emotional lag time. Right, because otherwise you think that you gain some knowledge and all of the emotions, all of the traumas mm-hmm. you've ever had, all of the likes and dislikes that you've had, just poof and go. It's not true at all. But instead, what happens is that all of those same likes and dislikes, same problems, same set of emotions now continue to rise up, but they continue to rise up in somebody who is different, who has a different understanding. And that allows them to fall off, and it takes place in time. So all of this is Maya, right? This whole process, all of the maturation, the gaining of the knowledge, the gaining itself of knowledge, the removing of the ajnanam, the falling off and the maturing, this all takes place within duality. Right? But the knowledge itself, the object of the knowledge, right, is not dvaita. The object of the knowledge is not mitya. Right? The object of the knowledge is satyam. The words are mitya, the Upanishads are mitya, the sisha is mitya, the guru is mitya, but what the knowledge is pointing out is there as is your very being, and that is satyam. And that is not something that's being created. That's something that's already absolutely here. It's just that the ignorance that causes the mind to superimpose all this duality onto me is what is removed. You know? The ignorance is removed by helping the mind to differentiate itself from what is the constant. The constant being, the conscious being that's illumining it. So that's the whole process. And as that process takes place, that upadesha means the teaching, then when that knowledge takes place, there's not an elimination of dvaita, as though something's going to go away. There's the recognition that there is no dvaita. Your subject-object relationship doesn't make for duality. In terms of if there's only one thing there, you know, like if you think of the clay relief statue, if you've got a big block of clay, and they've done like a bas relief into the clay with a very complex scene, and you've seen this complex, beautiful scene, and as you're experiencing it, you're also recognizing it as only clay. There's nothing there but clay. And here, even though you're seeing through your eyes and you have thoughts in your mind and emotions and the whole life, none of it is away from your being. Your being is the self of it. That dehatma buddhi, you know, that total conviction that my being is limited to this body, is broken. It's not there. It's there as mitya, but not there in any real way. Because there is no separation from any of your experiences. There is no separation from conscious being. You can't have an experience that's away from conscious being. And the totality of your experience enjoys it completely. And conscious being, so the conscious being you are is not so circumscribed, you know, by the upadhi, you know, that this is me. That's gone. You know, this is me is... That sense of meanness that this enjoys is mitya. But you can only say it's mitya when you recognize the truth of yourself, which is aparoksha. Aparoksha means it's direct, immediately recognized. It's not just a philosophy. It's something that you see. So that's what this verse is about. Now next week we're going back into the Upanishad. Let's take a moment. Rakshate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.